Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, welcome to the On the Ropes Boxing Radio Show. As every week, I am the hostess, Jenna J, joined by my producer slash co-host, Jeff Ciani, and of course, Nick Powers. And we're going to bring you the latest and greatest in the world of boxing. And fortunately, there wasn't that many great things that happened this past weekend, but there were some good fights, some fights worth mentioning. And the first one I want to get into here is Ivan Calderon. He is in the Pound for Pound Ring Magazine top 10, but not many people have heard of him. That is because he is a 108-pound fighter with, you know what, he's had an amazing career to this point here, but not many people have heard of him because it's that weight class. And this past week, he fought Jesus Uribe. You know, it's a typical thing for him. You know, every fight he goes into, he's ridiculously oversized, even at 108 pounds. And he goes out there, and he's just so slick and such a great boxer that he seems to get out of there almost unscathed. He got knocked down in the second round, showed a little bit of vulnerability there. But, you know, the guy right now, he's 34-0, only one draw. He's 35 years old, which is ancient for the weight class, but he still can do it. Remy, you watched this fight. What are your thoughts watching Ivan Calderon at work?
Well, I thought it was, you know, it wasn't a particularly exciting fight. It had a bit of a slow first round. It wasn't the type of fight that makes casual fans jump up and down and go crazy. But it was a brilliant tactical performance by Calderon, and it wasn't easy. It was difficult for him in the early going. As you mentioned, Jenna, 2 points. One, he looked much smaller than Uribe going into the ring. I mean, he looks tiny, even for 108 pounds. He's small for that weight class. And as you mentioned, he was dropped in the second round. And it's funny because we were both watching the fight. And at the time when, just before he got nailed with a shot coming in that dropped him, it looked to both of us as if there was no chance that he was going to be slick enough to get somebody like Calderon or Uribe. But then he nailed him coming in with a good shot. And Calderon got up. He didn't look too shaken. He got up pretty quickly. Looked like his head was clear. Looked like his legs were good. But he did look pretty shocked almost that he got caught the way he did. And I thought he came out more cautious in the third round. And it's worth noting, he had been doing very well in the second round. The first round I thought was kind of slow. In the second round, he was outboxing him. And he came out a little overcautious, I think, in round three. And I thought Uribe had built himself up a pretty nice lead in the early going. But then, in the sixth round, from that point forward, Calderon just dictated everything. He started moving around the ring, controlling the distance, working his little southpaw jab there, and it was opening up some really nice opportunities for some pretty good combinations he unleashed. And he came back and he won the fight, and there's no doubt he overcame adversity early when he was dropped. I think Uribe was doing a little bit better than the official judges' scorecards wound up reading. I had the fight a little closer than the judges did. I believe I had it 115-112 for Calderon, but it was an impressive effort. And for the pure boxing fans out there, the real diehard boxing fans that like watching a masterclass tactical performance, watching Ivan Calderon is always a pleasant thing for those type of fans. And I really did enjoy watching it because he does all these little things so well. And for a guy that is towered over by most of his opponents, he still finds a way to out-jab them, establish the jab, control his pace, and his footwork and ring generalship is just outstanding. As you said, Jenna, he's 34-0 now with one draw. He's almost 35 years old. He's ancient for the weight class. He did avenge that one draw with a win afterwards. He really is one of the most talented fighters out there. And in a lot of ways, it's a shame because some of these guys at the lower weight classes, they just don't get the recognition and credit that if he were 40 pounds heavier, he would be, his name would be plastered all over the place, kind of like a Floyd Mayweather Jr. He is that talented, but there isn't much interest in those lower weight classes amongst a lot of fans, even some diehards, especially not casual fans. But Yvonne Calderon is one of the greatest talents that we've seen, and even when he's getting older, he could still get the job done.
Yeah, I mean, that's the case, though. I mean, any of these weight classes below 115, they really don't get any attention at all. I mean, when Victor Arcinian was at 112, I mean, it did get some attention to some extent because of Showtime and them showcasing that weight division. But Calderon, he never gets showcased on HBO or Showtime or anything like that. You know, he was a long-time 105-pound champion. He was small for that weight class, too. I mean, he's only 5 foot tall, but he's got a decent reach, which is, he's got a 63-inch reach, which is actually pretty good for his weight class. That's the only reason he can compete with these big guys. But it is interesting, every fight you see him, and you know he's getting older, you know he's going to be slowing down a little bit, and you know one of these times he's going to step up against one of these big guys here, and when he gets caught, he ain't going to be able to take that shot, because he is tiny for the weight class. But, Nick, I mean, what are your impressions of Yvonne Calderon?
Well, both of you guys touched on really good points, of course, about Calderon's talent. I mean, he's a guy who's been undersized, Jenna, just like you mentioned, even at 105 pounds, which is kind of insane when you think about it. But the fact that he's only 34-0 with one draw, and he's avenged that loss, really speaks volumes about his talent level, just as Rum touched on. He's a guy who goes in there, and he has such a high level of talent in the ring and is able to do so many great things technically that he's able to overcome the size disadvantage he has against these fighters. And we've seen him go from 105 to 108, and it's uncertain as to what we're going to see him do in the future. Even though he is getting older, we might see him maybe go up to 112, maybe even 115, just to try and get a payday against one of the bigger names up there, like a Donaire or a D'Artagnan or someone like that. But being that he is small, even for 105, 108 pounds, you'd be hard-pressed to put him in there and favor him, even though he is so technically skilled. But I thought he looked great in there against Uribe. It was he did have to overcome adversity in the beginning, but that's another one of the great things about Calderon is he's able to keep his composure. He was able to overcome an early deficit and a knockdown and do what he does best, and that's be a tactician in the ring, and it was business as usual for him. And even though he is getting older, I think that the fact that he's still in the Ring magazine pound for pound list once again speaks volumes about his character and about his ability in the ring. He's sort of like a guy kind of like, because you mentioned about how he's not recognized that much, he's kind of in a way somewhat like Vladimir Klitschko, even though they're both physically on complete opposite sides of the spectrum. Klitschko's beaten everybody that he's been put in front of in recent years and has proven to be the best heavyweight in the world, yet he's still not recognized on most people's pound-for-pound lists for one reason or another. Calderon is because of his talent, but at the same time, he doesn't get the recognition that he deserves as a fighter. As Jenna mentioned, he's not on HBO, he's not on Showtime, and there aren't really many big fights that people care about in and around those really, really low weight classes. So I think for him to keep trooping on the way he has is really, really good for him, and I think it shows that there are people in boxing who take it seriously and do it the best way they can because it's a passion, it's something they love, and it's something that they look to continue to improve even as they get older. And the win against Uribe just reaffirmed that for me.
Yeah, I mean, and honestly, there is no move up. He can't make a move up. I think it'd be absolutely insane for him to go up to 112. I mean, as small as he is now, 108, and 115 would be actually suicide. I mean, seriously, he can't compete with guys that big. But there is still one interesting fight at 108 that he can make, that he can be involved with. And this coming weekend has a rematch of Rondel Maidal and Omar Romero. And the winner of that fight, that's a championship fight, could face off with Yvonne Calderon. That could be the biggest fight you can make at 108. But to be honest, at this point in his career, you know, he hasn't gotten the recognition. To be honest, the thing he's actually most known for is beating Miguel Cotto back in the amateurs. And that's crazy to think because you see he's 108 now and Miguel Cotto's at 154, but that actually did happen. I think he's got one or two more good fights in him. 35 is pretty old for the division, but the winner of the Maidal Ramiro fight, I think, is the way for him to go. But anyways, guys, there was another fight this past weekend that was interesting, and it was on ESPN2 Friday Night Fights. Now, that network is known for showcasing, you know, the up-and-coming talents, or sometimes maybe the older fighters that are getting one more shot against somebody, or, you know, all fights of that sort. But this one right here, it actually shows someone that could be a future star, and that would be David Lemieux. Now, he is 23-0 with 22 knockouts. He just knocked out Evan Ayala, who had gone 12 rounds with Arthur Abraham in a championship fight. It was very impressive. Now, he's a guy that I've actually been watching for quite a while, and you know, the last four or five fights, you can just look and you can see it in him. He just goes all out and goes for that knockout. And he has future star power because he is an action fighter. People love the way that he fights. He's a star. He's a growing star up in Canada. And literally, those first two rounds, he's like Mike Tyson in a sense because he goes out there. And those first two rounds, if you can get past that, you have a chance of getting him deeper. But most of his opponents, and that's literally 80% of his opponents, get knocked out in the first two rounds. Remy, what are your impressions of seeing Lemieux?
I think you nailed it right in your opening comments on that fight there, Jenna. He's an exciting fighter with tremendous star power. And he did just make very quick work of a man who went 12 rounds against Arthur Abraham. And as we all know, Arthur Abraham has some pretty devastating power. He could punch. And there's a lot of evidence of that. And the interesting thing is, as you said, with Lemieux's all-out aggressive type style that he comes out with to start these fights off, especially in recent times, you know, maybe he does or doesn't have the power of Abraham. I think it's really hard to gauge on where exactly they would compare in that regard, but we do know that they both had the power to stop Ayala, and we know that Lemieux did it in one round, whereas it took Abraham until the 12th round. But that, I think, really does all come down to the fighting style, because Arthur Abraham is the kind of guy that likes to hide in his little turtle shell, and he usually starts off slow, and all the fights he'd won until his last fight and his first loss, the disqualification loss to Andre Durrell, he often gives away the early rounds before he starts turning it on late, and his tremendous power usually wins the fights for him. Lemieux's got a totally different style than that, and he made a statement this Friday night with a great knockout victory. Certainly, that's only going to help the buzz that he's been able to create thus far in his young career. And I think it might be time for him to start thinking about stepping it up a notch in the near future. I think that we need to see more of him not being able to stop these guys so early like that so that we could get a better way to see where he's at right now.
Yeah, well, I agree with that, though. He does need to be stretched out in his fights a little bit to worry that he's gone 10 rounds once, and I think he's the only other fight that even went past three rounds, went five. So, you know, he does need to get in there, one of those tough guys with a great chin that can give him a bit of a test. But if you look at the middleweight division, there isn't really any huge names out there or guys that can really test that. I mean, you got Felix Durham, he's a longtime champion. Kelly Pavlik's moving up in weight. I mean, you got Sylvester, who fights, you know, he fights over in Germany. You're not going to see that fight there. I mean, there's Anthony Modine. His chin's been tested and failed quite a few times. So at this division, there isn't really any big names or anything for him to fight. But do you know what I actually like to see him fight? I'd like to see him fight another prospect like Danny Jacobs. I think that would be a true test. Put these two prospects against each other, see where they're at, see who's ready for their championship fight. I think Lemieux's more ready. I think he's literally two, it might be even bold to say it, but I honestly believe he's two fights away from getting a title shot, and I believe he could be successful if matched with the right guy at middleweight. Nick Powers, what are your thoughts on Lemieux?
Well, I thought he looked pretty sensational in this fight. One of the things I noticed was Ayala's balance seemed to be a little bit off. I remember seeing him throw a straight right hand, a lead straight right hand, and his balance just seemed really, really screwy, and Lemieux just seemed so comfortable in the ring, moving around, staying on his toes, and he just seemed like his style was so much better of a fit to really give Ayala fits, unlike Abraham, who Rummy mentioned is a notoriously slow starter. And I think that Lemieux's intent on coming out and starting quicker is definitely something that we need for someone to be a star, especially in the middleweight division, which is lacking star power, Jenna, like you mentioned. And it also shows why his knockout percentage, is the way that it is. So he looked very good. It's a little bit tough to gauge how he looks in just one round, but three knockdowns against a guy who went 12 without their Abraham is pretty good. I do think that I would like to see him matched up against somebody like Jacobs, maybe even somebody from if people from 54 move up, whether or not you could put him in there against John Duddy, who was campaigning at 54 but looks to be going back to 60. Maybe even Julio Cesar Chavez Jr. should he move up, or even maybe a guy like James Kirkland when he comes out of jail. You know, you never know what his body's going to be feeling like, if he's going to feel the itch to move up or anything. But Lemieux is definitely a guy who you've got to be on the lookout for, and another guy who looks to have a lot of international success with the French-speaking audience as well, maybe another Lucien Boutte, somewhere like that, which actually might not be a bad matchup somewhere down the line if he decides to move up to 168 pounds. But I thought he looked really, really good this past weekend. I was pretty impressed with him.
Yeah, and you know what? I mean, if he doesn't even want to fight a prospect, you know, a guy that you could put him in with that's at 160 pounds is pretty interesting would be Marco Antonio Rubio. He's got the title shot. He's a tough veteran. He's gone 12 rounds numerous times with good fighters, good punchers. He went, I think, 10 rounds with Kelly Pavlik. That's a good test. That's a good step up. That's a good way to gauge where he's at. You know what? I think that's a good move for him. Hopefully, we just get to see more of him. I think HBO, Showtime, they should get this guy on their network here. I mean, he's 22 knockouts. He's got action style. I think the American fans will certainly enjoy watching a little bit more of him. But anyways, guys, it's time for our first guest this week's show. We have trainer and ESPN boxing analyst Teddy Atlas on with us now. How are you doing today, Teddy?
Everything's good. How are you?
I'm doing fine. We're happy to have you in the show, and I'm definitely looking forward to discussing the current landscape of boxing with you. And I'd first like to start off by asking you, you currently train Alexander Povetkin. There's been a lot of talk lately in boxing that the next fight for him could be with Vladimir Klitschko. How are those thoughts going?
Everything's good. I mean, the only reason I'm back training fighters is because Alexander Povetkin is a kid, I think, with good character. He's a terrific kid to work with. It's actually nice to be in the gym. I didn't want to be in the gym anymore and deal with some of the things that you have to deal with in this business, but it has been fun with him, and his character has been a big part of it, bringing me back to the teaching part of boxing. And right now we're planning on bringing him into New Jersey, where we set up a training camp next week to start training for what is going to be in front of us. We're not sure if it's going to be Klitschko. If it is, it'll probably be sometime in the fall. But again, we're the mandatory, but we're not sure. Klitschko is also negotiating to fight David Haye, and we're going to see how that negotiation goes. If that negotiation goes forward and Klitschko indeed fights Haye, then we would do what I think would be right for my fighter, Povetkin, which would be to get some more development fights, stay busy, and continue to move forward and progress as a fighter. If that's not the case, and the mandatory is going to be presented to us in the fall, then we'll start getting ready to fight Klitschko. But like I said, next week I'm going to bring him in for what I call a mini camp, just to start to put some of the strategy in place if we are going to fight Klitschko, and just to continue learning in the gym.
Now, what do you think you've improved in Alexander Povetkin in the fights that you've worked with him on?
Well, one of the things we're improving is for him to see and recognize things a little better, to be a little calmer, to be able to see what his options are in the ring, and to improve his defense, to allow his defense to be part of his offense. You make somebody miss, you create opportunities offensively. To be more definitive about what it is that he's trying to do when he steps inside the ropes. In other words, to have a better sense of his identity. You know, sometimes he would think about boxing, other times he would think about pressing and, you know, being a forward-moving guy. I wanted him to know at all times, you know, really what it is that he's trying to accomplish, what his identity is, and to try to be more definitive, more concise with those things, more productive, more effective. His punches to be a little shorter. He's a pretty good body puncher, set up opportunities to be able to use that asset a little bit more, use his jab more. Be a fighter who's just as efficient as possible, and a fighter that again knows exactly what his opportunities, what his thoughts should be when he's getting in that ring, not to waste opportunities, you know, always looking to create things and be as efficient as possible.
Now, you trained a lot of heavyweights in your career, but you know, what is your assessment of Alexander Povetkin as a fighter? I mean, what things, when you decide to take on this challenge, did you see that you liked that made you want to take on this, this challenge of getting him ready for a title shot?
Well, I really didn't want to train fighters anymore. They had invited me a year ago to go to Russia. At first, I said no. And they talked me into going out there for a week to work with him. And given an opportunity just to meet him. And his character, his personality, but his character. He's an honest kid. There's no real airs about him. There's no BS about him. He was very straightforward. And he was very honest about that, the fact that he thought that he could and should still develop more in more dimensions, that there was room for this kind of development, this kind of improvement. And he had expressed that he would never leave Russia. Real hometown kid, real small town kid, and very nationalistic, and he had said that he would not ever want to come to the U.S. and, again, leave his country. And after I worked with him for a week, and obviously he would understand that in order for me and him to work, that he would have to leave Russia, he said that he would be willing to do that, and he would gladly do that for the opportunity to learn more. And, you know, making that kind of, being honest about it, that in the past he wasn't prepared to leave, and now that he was prepared to make that sacrifice, that kind of commitment, that change in his life, that showed me a lot. And just that it brought out, it reminded me that, you know, the thing that I was first in this business before I fought years ago, the real thing that tied me to this business was teaching, you know, being a trainer, but teaching, helping somebody improve, helping somebody get from one place to another place, where maybe you can be part of that journey and part of the success of that journey. And, you know, I had gotten to the point where the other parts of boxing chased me away from it. The disloyalty, the betrayal, the excuses, the lies, the managers, the promoters, their end of it, and what their end clearly usually is, which is just about the money. It kind of tainted the sport for me and chased me away, made me not want to be around it anymore. And he kind of, you know, revigorated the notion that it's still great when you're in the gym alone. There's nothing quite like being in the gym alone, away from all the rest of it, and teaching, being able to impart something to a person and watching them grow right in front of you, watching them grow, not just technically and physically, which is part of it, but emotionally, knowing that they could do something they weren't sure they could do before, knowing they could try something that they weren't sure that they should even try before, getting a little more confidence. And watching that kind of development is something that once you're a teacher, it's always with you. And when it's brought back, it reminds you of why you invested in the business, why you were in the business to begin with. And that's been a pretty good thing.
Great. Now, currently in the heavyweight division, the person that they consider to be the heavyweight champion is Vladimir Klitschko. But you, as a trainer, what do you see in Vladimir Klitschko? I mean, what is your assessment of him as a fighter?
Well, he's not the prettiest guy to watch. You know, he's not the most entertaining or enticing guy. He's not going to bring ratings up. I mean, they sell out a lot of stadiums in Europe and in Germany specifically. And if he fights David Hay, I guess they would sell out in Wembley over in England, because there's not a lot of challenges to the sport over there. There's not, you know, there's not LeBron James and Kobe Bryant and you know, baseball and football and all the other sports. And when they promote properly over there, they identify with the fighters. And they make big events over there, and they bring in crowds that we don't bring in the United States. So they do very well in that way. But as far as the TV market, the TV part of it, you know, they're not the most enticing, stylistic guys to watch, but they're very effective. You have to give them credit. They've made a lot of money. They've accomplished a lot personally and professionally. And they're the best guys out there right now. They know what they are. they understand their identities, their ring identities, and they've developed mentally. You know, the older brother has developed mentally, and the younger brother has developed mentally a little bit, not as much as the older brother, but he takes his great physical assets and attributes, which is size and strength, and he puts himself in a position where he can use them in such a consistent manner that any of his shortcomings are hidden a little bit. They're hidden behind a great wall where to get to those shortcomings, you got to get past his physical abilities, which is controlling range, using height, using the jab to keep his opponents at a certain distance where he can catch them before they can catch him, and therefore he puts the pressure on them to take the chances to make the fight, to take the chances to get into offensive position. He makes them take chances, and then he capitalizes on their recklessness. He capitalizes on their chances. And when they take chances, he's ready to hit them with the right hand, which he's a good straight right hand, a good, accurate, powerful right hand puncher. And so he forces you to fight his fight. He forces you, you know, in a position where it's very hard to exploit his weaknesses, and he accentuates his strengths. And, you know, he's become very consistent. And if he has any shortcomings in the mental areas where he's been stopped in the past, where he's been disintegrated by pressure, he's, again, become so consistent with using his physical tools that he hides those shortcomings very well. He surrounds them. He really insulates himself from those shortcomings. And he makes it a very difficult proposition to get in the ring with him. He's 6'7", he's, you know, 245 pounds, and again, he's keeping you at a range that's good for him, bad for you, and you take the chances, he doesn't take the chances, and then he looks to knock your head off with the right hand. And if you get close to him, in the dimensions that he's not as comfortable, that he's not, you know, obviously as good at, he will grab you, you know, he will entangle you and wait for the referee to get you back into the dimensions that are good for him again. So he's a difficult task, and he's become more and more confident in his ability, you know, to do these things with whoever he's in the ring with. And we would have to understand very clearly, you know, what our fight plan would have to be. There's not a lot of margin for error because he's a good puncher. You make a mistake somewhere along the line, he has a chance to really make you pay ultimately for that mistake. So you'd have to have a very clear, proper fight plan. And then you'd have to have, obviously, the technique and the discipline to carry that technique out.
Great. Well, Teddy, we're also joined by my co-host, Jeff Ciani. Jeff?
Hello, Teddy. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Oh, my pleasure.
And it's a special pleasure for me to have you on the show because I was recently talking to my father and my aunt, and your father, Dr. Atlas, was actually their family doctor when they were growing up on Staten Island, and they were a pretty poor family, regular family that had their struggles. And from all the accounts I hear of your father, he was a great man, and my dad and my aunt have hoped that I'd get a chance to interview you for a long time. They always joke that he would make house calls, and no matter what, he would always charge something like $2, and he was always a very reasonable, kind, and generous man. And the first question I'd like to ask you, Teddy, deals with the foundation you created based on the principles that you learned from your father, and I'm wondering if you could share a little bit with our audience about your foundation and the inspiration behind starting it, and if you could just tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I'd be glad to. I appreciate you asking. My father, as you just touched on, he was a doctor, he was a GP, general practitioner, and he practiced medicine 55 years, and you know, he understood what a doctor should be as a human being, not just as a practicer of medicine. And, you know, He took care of people for all those years. He founded two hospitals. He actually founded a hospital called Sunnyside that had 20 beds in it on Staten Island many, many years ago. And the genesis of that, the inspiration of it, was that he found there was a lot of poor people back in those days. There were no HMOs. There was no real health care. And either you could afford to get hospitalization or you couldn't. And they used to do a lot of tonsillectomies in those days where kids needed to get their tonsils removed. And a simple thing like that was a big procedure for a family that couldn't afford it. And he wound up doing free, it just became a thing where he decided he would do free tonsillectomies on Wednesdays in his office. And he would just make a makeshift operating room. And he would lay down cots and blankets and pillows mostly. And he'd operate on the kids and then hold them during the day, because when you did tonsillectomies those days, you had to make sure that the patient didn't hemorrhage afterwards. So he'd hold them during the day, and at night they would pick them up. The parents would pick up the kids. And that grew to the point where, I mean, he couldn't even accommodate in the office anymore. So he said, you know, I have to go build a hospital. So he built this little 20-bed hospital. And again, what he basically did was he took care of people that needed to get hospitalized, and, you know, he absorbed the cost himself. The ones that could pay for it paid for it, and it helped carry the bills. But the rest of them, he just, as I said, he absorbed it. And he did that for 20-somewhat years. And then the city built the highway, and they built the Verrazano Bridge and the highway leading to the Verrazano Bridge. And the hospital was right in the area where the highway was going to be. So they came to my father, they bought the hospital from him, they tore it down, they put the highway up, and he founded another hospital, a doctor's hospital with 60 doctors, and he continued, you know, to do things the same way. And I just figured, you know, he did house calls, he practiced till he was 80. And I figured that everybody feels a little mortality. And when you get older, you start thinking of your legacy, and more importantly, I think, even if you don't think of your legacy, I think you start thinking about, is there somebody up there that's going to maybe not open that door up, if there is such a thing? And you start thinking, you know, maybe I should live a certain way. But, you know, and that's a little different if you do it for those reasons. Not that you're not adding to humanity and you're not getting credit for doing good things, but your inspiration's a little different. And he did it for 55 years. So I would have to assume he did it for other reasons. Before, he was thinking about whether or not there was a keeper at the gates up in the sky somewhere that might keep him out. He was doing it for a little longer than that. And I just figured, you know, he did house calls till he practiced till he was 80, did house calls up to the time he was 80. He was charging $2-3 for house calls, if he charged you at all. He was giving free medication to people, you know, and he was making sure that everybody got the treatment they should get, despite of the place they were in life, whether or not they had money or they had no money. And he went everywhere. He went into the projects. He went everywhere there was somebody sick and somebody needy. And he did it in a very unassuming way. So I figured when he died, I said, you know, I'd like to start something to remember him and remember him in the kind of way that he lived. So we started this foundation 13 years ago, Dr. Atlas Foundation, and the whole idea was bring help to people, not just with muscular dystrophy, not just with cerebral palsy, not just with cancer, but a young mother, single mom who's trying, and she's got four kids and it's too much, and she's going to be kicked out of her apartment and put into a shelter. We make sure that doesn't happen. We come in and we pay the rent. You know, a child is on cancer treatment, and the cancer treatment, the insurance is going to discontinue. It's not going to keep up the treatment program. We step in and we pick up the insurance and make sure the treatment program does not stop. A child needs to fly to a different treatment program. The family can't afford to fly them out of state, out of town. We step in and we pick up those costs, and we also pick up the costs for the hotel and make sure that the family can get there and take care of that. There's a ramp needs to be put on the side of a house for an invalid child, or an adult, whoever it happens to be. We make sure that ramp gets put up there. All these things, and we do them every day of the year. And our mission statement is to take care of people that sometimes would have kind of fallen through the cracks, had nowhere else to go. And we take care of it in a direct manner. You know, we take care of it in a manner where They don't have to wait 3 months. They don't have to beg. They don't have to plead to get it. We identify it. We validate that it's real, and we act on it. And if there's a mission statement, the mission statement from the beginning has been, don't make the people lose more than they've lost already. Anybody coming to us, they've lost something. We understand that. Don't make them lose their dignity. Don't make them lose their pride. You know, identify it, be responsible that it's real, and act on it. And one of the things that stayed with me with my father was when he died, all the people, the thousands of people that came out, some of the nurses would talk about, you know, the kind of man that he was and how he would go into the hospital and he'd go into the nursing homes. He was the director of about 9 nursing homes. And the reason for it was every nursing home needed to have a doctor as a medical director back in those days to stay open. But the doctors wouldn't do it because they didn't get paid enough. So he wound up being the medical director of all these nursing homes. And the nurses told me, they said, you know, he didn't have to come to any of these places. He just had to have his name on so we could stay open. But he came every week to see these old people that people have forgotten about, you know, to a great extent. And some of them were senile, some of them weren't, but they were all lonely. And he would come there once a week, and he would make sure he did his rounds in all 9 nursing homes that he was down as the medical director. He would take his time, and he'd go to each room. And I thought that was worth remembering somebody who lived that way. And also, one of the stories that the patients told me during his wake, they said, do you know, he would do house calls at all hours, and he would come sometimes at 1 in the morning, 12 at night, 11 at night, whatever it was. And we couldn't afford to pay him, and he understood that. And he would stay there and have a cup of tea. So one of the patients said, do you know why he always had a cup of tea? I said, well, he loved tea. I just figured it gave him a little caffeine and kept him going. You know, and he had a sweet tooth. I said, I'm sure you gave him a piece of cake. And they laughed. They said, he loved cheesecake. We give him a piece of cheesecake. We give him a cup of tea. But do you know why? I said, yeah, because he had a sweet tooth and the caffeine would keep him going. And the patients were a lot smarter than me, a lot smarter. And that's not hard to be. And they said, no, the reason he did it was that we were given something back, so we wouldn't feel we were getting charity. And then it made sense. Immediately, I understood that as truth. I said, yeah, that's why he did it. You're right. You're absolutely right. That's why he did it. And that's how we do the foundation. And we're every day of the week, we're getting calls. And I get a little nervous. Can we keep this up? It's been 13 years. We've given $5 million. And what I feel good about it, I wish it was $50 million. I wish it was $15 million. But it's $5 million of pure money. We don't have any administrative costs of family costs. They need a wheelchair, we get them the wheelchair. You know, they whatever it is that has to be done to help that person's quality of life and that situation, we're able to act on it. And everything goes to the right things. We also have a food pantry that feeds people in the New York area that unfortunately go to bed hungry sometimes with children. And to the point that we can help that, our food pantry has been helping that. And we also have programs where we go into schools. We call them the Dr. Atlas Foundation Incentive Programs. We go into at-risk schools where there's kids that aren't coming from the best backgrounds, and they've been struggling in the school. And we go into the schools, and we tell them, okay, look, you have about 2 months to the next marking period. The kids that improve their behavior, that give up some of the gang stuff outside, that start coming on a regular basis. They don't have to become A students, but they have to make their – one thing that I will not give in on is their attendance has to be perfect. So if they come to school, if their behavior changes, their attitude changes, they show this, then we put them on. The teachers will make a list of the ones who get on that list. So maybe the school has 600 students. So I'll leave 100 tickets, and we'll get the bus. And the only thing we ask the schools to do is to provide the chaperones with the teachers to go with the kids. And we'll get 100 tickets for a Met game, for a Yankee game, for a Knicks game, for a Nets game. And it makes a big difference for them. We'll go to all these different schools. So we might give out 1,000 tickets during the course of the year in these kind of incentive programs. And you'd be shocked how a little thing, like letting a kid know that you care about them, a little thing, because a lot of these kids have nobody at home letting them know that, nobody. And that's their problem. They're not bad kids. they get into bad things, and for different reasons. And some of them, when you take a moment to understand it, it's pretty understandable. And just letting them know that somebody cares about how they do. All of a sudden, they care about how they do. And when they care about how they do better. And so the foundation was born for this reason, in this spirit. 13 years ago, we're going into our 14th year. We depend on one very big dinner, always in November, the week before Thanksgiving, where we get different celebrity guests to come, and they're good enough to come out to make the dinner a big dinner on Staten Island at the Hilton Hotel, where that's our biggest fundraiser. We do other ones now because we need to, because the demand, the call for help seems to get greater almost every day. But we feel good about, you know, again, what the foundation stands for, what it does, and whose name it's in.
Well, Teddy, I think, first of all, that that's a great thing you're doing with that foundation. I think that's very admirable of you. And to reiterate what I said earlier, from all accounts I've heard from my father and my aunt, your dad was a great man. And it's funny, when you mentioned the tea and the cheesecake, one of the stories my dad and my aunt shared with me was one time your father had made a house call, and he'd actually stayed over for dinner and watched a ball game with my grandfather, who has since passed away. And I just wanted to tell you, I think that's a great thing you're doing. And from all accounts I've heard, it sounds like you're carrying your father's legacy on very well. And changing things up somewhat from that, my dad had read your book, and he'd given me the book after he had read it. And I read your book, and I was a big fan of it. And one aspect of the book that really stuck out with me was the whole book was written and about the importance of character, and you were very frank throughout the whole book, and I appreciated that. But the part about the smokers, the unsanctioned amateur bouts in the South Bronx, where you would take a group of your young fighters from the Catskills there every week, and I believe there was a young fighter who wasn't the most talented fighter who needed some confidence building. I believe his name was Maine Moore. And I was wondering maybe if you could share a little bit about some of those experiences, because that was one of the most interesting aspects of the book to me. And I thought what you did, I think you did that for 5, 6, or maybe even 7 years you were doing that. I was just wondering if you could maybe share a little bit on that.
Yeah, sure,
audience.
No problem. I mean, that was a formative part of my youth and my development as a trainer, where I trained the kids up in Catskill with Custom Autos, and I did all the training, and Cuz would come in the gym maybe only once a week at night just to overlook everything and see what was going on. And, you know, I had the responsibility and the trust of everybody up there to develop these kids that came into the gym. And we did a pretty good job with it. And from pro fighters to amateur fighters, and all these kids, once they learned, I would keep them on the floor, teach them the basics. And once they learned the basics, then I would let them box, and I would always let them box with more experienced guys. Why? And I think people should understand this, is because if you put them in with inexperienced kids, they're just going to be, you know, flailing away and not gaining much and doing some damage. But if you put them in with a more experienced fighter, he can control himself, he can play defense and control his ego, control his discipline, his temperament, and have enough skills where he doesn't have to hurt the kid. He can let the kid develop. He can let the kid get his feet under him, let the kid learn. And this way, you develop fighters that way, and you don't lose fighters. You don't get them discouraged. And a lot of kids, if you give them a chance, they will develop. If you give them a chance and you teach them properly. And then once we got to that point where they could start sparring in a, you know, more accelerated rate, where I could let them start boxing with guys and letting other guys, you know, take their handcuffs off them a little bit more, and they were ready, then you had to take them out to get experience. And there wasn't a lot of places upstate to get too much experience. There were some places. So I started taking them down to the Bronx and to these smokers. And, you know, it was quite an atmosphere. It was almost its own world. It was its own world. And you went down there you have to understand the atmosphere. I mean, it was quite a atmosphere. You go down to the South Bronx under the L train on Westchester Avenue, and a lot of the buildings were blown out, and it looked like a war zone. There was only certain buildings left standing. There was a lot of stuff going on, and a lot of these kids had never seen that before. So you know their hearts were pounding. But that was part of the development, facing things, learning new things, meeting new people, different cultures. And, you know, and again, it was a responsibility. I had to make sure the kids were okay. And you take them to these smokers. I did all the matchmaking. I made sure that they were matched right. And that itself was quite a journey and, you know, quite an experience, because everybody was lying about how many fights their kids had. They all wanted an edge. But after a while, you understood what the code was. You understood what the lies were. So it was really, it was like you were speaking the truth just in scripted ways and in coded ways. Like if somebody said they had no fights, well, you knew they had three fights. You know, they had two to three. If they said they had, you know, two or three, well, then you knew they had probably eight or nine. You know, if they ever dared to admit that they had, you know, anywhere near seven, eight, or nine, well, then you knew that they were close to being a pro. I mean, they were an open fighter. They probably had 30 fights. So there was a way of understanding. You had to understand that to look out for your kids. That was what you were dealing with, and you had to understand all those things and all those dimensions. Otherwise, you were just going to be a babe in the woods, and you shouldn't be a babe in the woods when you have kids that you're responsible for. You can't afford to do that. You have to protect those kids. And so I'd make sure that I would match them right and go about that business and have to get them experience so they could start to get calmer in the ring, start to grow in the ring, start to see things they needed to see. And the only way to do that was to, you know, get real fights. And this was one of the places to do it. So we'd go down every week and go down there, take the 3 hour to 2.5, 3 hour drive. And you have to understand your fighters during the drive, what was going on. Their imagination was starting to chip away at them, you know, and started to deteriorate them. So you had to talk to them about that. You had to let them come out front about how nervous they were, which most people want to hide that. You don't want to let nobody know, because you're brought up thinking that's an inferiority. That's a flaw. That there's a yellowness to that. There's a cowardness to that. And, of course, nothing could be further from the truth, because all that matters was that you were ready to face it, you were prepared to face it, you were going to face it, but being scared was part of the deal, part of, you know, what everybody went through. But most people think that it's private to them. So you try to let them understand it's not private to them. And when they understand that, then it's much easier to deal with. And it's tangible. It's not something that's not tangible, that nobody else has. It's not a disease. And so you're going through a lot of things here with these kids. And you understand that even the ones that aren't going to become pro fighters or top amateur fighters, they're going to get better from this experience. They're going to learn to use these things in ways in their life that will serve them in a beneficial way, and where they can be more complete as people in so many ways. And you also learn that you can lose a kid. If you match them wrong, you can lose a kid. You can lose a kid not physically, but emotionally, mentally, spiritually, where he gives up on himself, where he gets more closed down. So there's a lot going on. And you go down there and you know, you go into these dark buildings and everything's bombed out, and you're going in and you got to walk three flights of steps and there's urine in the hallways. And in those days there was some, you know, syringes laying in the hallways where people would shoot up. I mean, there was a lot of difficult things going on in these areas. And you're walking right past all that. And then you get upstairs, and you got the Latin music, the bongo drums, the salsa music playing. And, you know, you just know these kids are, and try not to show it, but inside, again, they're terrified. And you walk in there, and the place is packed, and they're selling all kinds of Spanish dishes, the potatoes with the meat in the middle, the fried bananas, everything to make money so they can pay the rent. But it's an important thing, running these smokers. It pays for the rent. It allows a lot of kids to come into the gym for free, because this will subsidize the gym. And there's plenty of liquor that's flowing. And obviously it's not a subsidized match. It's a smoker. And there's no doctor. So you have to look out for the kids. You have to make sure that you're taking care of all the things that have to be taken care of. But you also, you're seeing kids that are 15 years old waiting for a fight, and next to them is their girlfriend with their one-year-old child. And so, you know, you understand that this is one of the positive things going on in this area, in this neighborhood, that kids are trying to find themselves. Kids are trying to do something positive. Kids are trying to accomplish something where they haven't had a chance to accomplish anything, and they think this is their chance to accomplish something in a way that will move them forward. And, you know, it's just a whole world of different things going on. And then you got kids that are 8 years old, 7 years old. I know a lot of the fans will be saying, my God, is that possible? Yeah, it's possible. I mean, you had 8-year-old, 9-year-old, 7-year-old kids. Some of them already had 20 fights. They were fighting. And so you do the matching. I wound up being a matchmaker, have to do and, you know, go through all that. And a lot of the people didn't speak English, so we'd have to figure it all out and, you know, get everything. Sometimes we put on as many as 15, 16, 17, 18, 19 fights. Because we had that many kids, we wanted to make sure they all fought, if they could be matched appropriately. And I had a kid, and all these different kids that I was bringing down there at different levels of experience, and most of them inexperienced. And one of them was a kid named Moore, who, when he first came into the gym up in Catskill, he came in there in a way where, you know, he just came in the gym and, you see, he was a very shy kid. You see that he was a kid that wasn't outgoing, and he wasn't even sure what to say. And so I went over to him and started talking to him, and kind of, you know, I knew that he was looking for something. It was, you know, he was looking to help himself in some way. There was something that was driving him here. It wasn't just to be a fighter per se. And it turned out, I did some investigating. I had some of the kids check him out. It turned out he was being picked on at school by a kid named Goo, a real bully. Would take his lunch money every day, humiliate him every day. And, you know, he just knew that he should gravitate to the gym. And but he didn't know what to say. He didn't know he wanted to be. He just didn't want Goo to take his lunch money anymore. That's about all he knew. And he came in the gym, and he couldn't even talk. So I started talking for him. I understood why he was there. I had an instinct of he's here for a reason. I didn't know exactly what it was yet, but I knew it was along certain lines. That's why kids come to the gym to a certain extent. And so I told him to throw a jab, and, you know, it wasn't the best jab, but I told him that's a pretty good jab, and he was, like, shocked. He said, it is? I said, yeah, it's not a bad jab. I said, you've done this before? He goes, no, never. I said, really? I said, you got a pretty good jab. I said, come here tomorrow at 6 o'clock. And it took everything away, all the weight off of him of having to figure out how he was going to get in the gym. And he started coming, and, you know, when I would teach him things, it was okay. But then when we got in the ring and when it came time to get in with a controlled guy that could box with him a little bit, just the thought of it would make him cry. So I take the time, I talk to him and, you know, go outside the hallway and take a little time and explain to him that the only difference between him and the other kids was in some ways he was more honest. And he said, what do you mean by that? I said, well, you show your feelings. Other people learn how to not show their feelings. That's all. And he said, you mean other people feel that way? No one else could probably doesn't feel as scared as me. Or I said, no, everybody does. And we'd go through all that. And you know, when it came time to finally bring him down to the Bronx, I had to make sure I had the right guy. So I waited till I found the right guy, and sure enough, I found a kid named Raul Rivera. And when they fought the first time, they did more holding than punching. And that was fine, because it was just about going through the process, getting in the ring, facing your fears, facing your inhibitions, all your doubts, all the boogeymen. It might as well have been a thriller in Manila in their minds. You know, everybody else is watching two guys just grab each other and do a waltz, but not to them. It's LaMotta and Basilio in their minds. And afterwards, the proprietor of the gym, a friend of mine, Nelson Cuevas, good guy, he said, you know, hey, that's going to be that. I'm glad that's over with. Never see that again. I said, no, you won't see that again till next week. He said, what are you talking about? Till next week? What do you mean till next week? I said, well, we're putting it on again next week. He goes, Teddy, you got to be kidding me. You're killing me. I said, no, we're putting it on next week. Put it on next week. Same thing happened. He said, I'm glad that's over with. I said, well, it's over with till next week because you'll be seeing it again. And I just let him keep fighting. I wasn't going to put him with anyone else and take a chance. And after about three times, four times, they fought about five, six times in a row. But after about three or four, they started throwing punches. They started fighting. They started getting a little better. Even Nelson himself couldn't. He said, I can't believe it. These guys are actually almost looking like fighters. And he developed into a pretty good fighter. But more importantly, he went on to college. He went on to other things. He didn't become a pro. But he did things that boxing helped him find the confidence to do those things. And, you know, that's what the smokers were for to me. And that to me, that's what boxing's for. I know it's about making world champions and that, but it's about making men, taking boys and making them into men. It's about letting somebody know that they have something good in them, find themselves. To me, that's what boxing, that's the magic. If it's done right, nothing does it like that. And there was one other kid named Gary Young, who, when he came in the gym, he came in, I remember, I couldn't understand a word he said. He was about 10 years old. He was 50 pounds, 55 pounds. And when he was talking, I didn't even realize he kept his hand over his lip. And I couldn't understand a word he was saying. But, again, I understood instinctively to nod and let him think I understood him because I knew he was there for the same kind of reason Maine was there. And I figured it out sooner or later. And sure enough, by the end, I just said, be here tomorrow at 6 o'clock. And he said, okay, and he dropped his hand for the first time. And I saw that he had a hair lip. You know, he had a cleft palate. And he was disfigured. It was pretty severe. And obviously he had a speech impediment. And that's why he was there, because in class it turned out, you know, kids would pick on him, make fun of him a little bit, and he wouldn't participate in class. So people thought he was stupid. And of course, nothing could be further from the truth, but, you know, he was glad to let people think that. If in exchange he would get silence and wouldn't have to talk. And so we let him start developing. The same thing. I got on my knees. I threw jabs at him, wore out a couple pairs of dungarees, and, you know, let him start to grow. Let him start to find himself. This kid became a hell of an amateur fighter. He was one of the toughest kids that I ever had in the gym. And he was unbelievable. He was like a Carmen Basilio. And he just flourished. And as time went on, we didn't pay attention to it, but as time went on, obviously I'm talking to him every day and understanding everything. I never even realized that, you know, I understand everything he said. And I would make all the kids bring their report cards in. That was part of the deal. You had to pass your classes. You couldn't fail more than one. Whatever, I forget exactly. It's been 35 years. But, you know, there was a deal that, you know, you had to you might have been allowed to fail one. I'm not even sure if you were allowed to fail one. But you had to have your marks pretty much at a passing level. And obviously all the comments by the teachers had to be positive comments. So they would have to bring their report cards in every marking period. You know, they would bring them in. And Gary brought his report card in. And from the one before the gym, before he started with the gym, he had failed everything. And again, it was because he wasn't participating in class. And now he passed everything. And, you know, not with 80s, but 65, 70s, but it didn't matter. He passed everything. But the thing that really I'll never forget, and obviously that's why I'm telling the story, is that under the teacher's remarks, it said, you know, Gary is improved tremendously. He participates in class with other students now, which he never did in the past, and we couldn't be happier. And then P.S., please keep up the speech therapy classes. They're working wonders. And, you know, I turned to Cuss, the model, and I said, Cuss, they think we're giving them speech therapy classes. And Cuss, I'll never forget it, Cuss said, see what you're doing, Atlas? Boxing's supposed to destroy speech and wreck speech. and you're showing that it actually that it improves speech. And it was just a great lesson of what self-confidence can do. But you have to have a place to get that self-confidence. You have to have a well to go to drink that self-confidence. And boxing, as unlikely as it might seem to a lot of politicians and a lot of people out there that are just ignorant of the sport, and I'm not knocking them, but they are. They're just ignorant of what the sport really is about. They would be well served to learn that.
Well, Teddy, I want to thank you for sharing that great account. As I said to you, that was my favorite part of the book, and listening to you give firsthand accounts of those experiences was very interesting for me as a listener. I appreciate that. And referring back to your book for a minute, Willem Dafoe said, "Teddy Atlas taught me a lot about human nature through boxing." And in a lot of ways, that's something I got from your book. And it was funny because reading your book, I almost felt like I could hear your voice in an audio book, because I guess I'm so used to watching your commentating on Friday night fights and so used to the way you talk that it was written just like that, and it was a very enjoyable read. But back to Dafoe, you had to train him, somebody with no boxing experience, for a movie called Triumph of the Spirit. And I'm wondering if you could also perhaps share some of your accounts on what it was like working with him and what it was like to try to train somebody who had never boxed, where you had to make it in a short time so that it was believable that he was a fighter from that era in the movie, and how you went about doing that.
Well, I mean, you go about it the same blueprint. You know, you're organized about what you're doing, hopefully, and you teach fundamentals. You know, if I never built a house, and I've never built a house, I would know enough to dig a foundation. I would know enough to get cinder blocks, you know, and that the basement is the first part of the house. I would understand that. And it's not much different in boxing, even if you have a guy who's not a boxer for trade, and he's not going to be a boxer for trade. You teach the fundamentals, you know, from the ground up, from the foot placement to the balance to where they keep their hands to the understanding of throwing the proper kind of punches without warning, where you can get full power and at the same time not waste any motion and not telegraph anything. Where you move after your last punch, so you have defense added to the equation of offense, where you understand what range you should be punching at. You should also understand when you should and shouldn't punch. There's a time to and a time not to punch. You understand that kind of judgment. You explain those things. You show those things. You're a teacher. And they learn. And it reminded me that the quality, the most important, doesn't not just the box, it's not the trade that you're in, you know, but it's about the same qualities that all professional people, if they get to that level where you could actually give them the great praise of being called a professional, no matter what it is that they're into, whether it's boxing, whether it's being a doctor, a carpenter, a teacher, a lawyer, whatever it is, that the qualities are consistent. That they control their emotions, they work hard, they understand where the concentration and dedication needs to be, where it must be, you know, and they allow themselves to learn. But the most important thing a professional does is he learns to make himself do and make himself accountable to do what has to be done, whatever that profession calls for, no matter how he might be feeling at that moment. That's consistent as a pro, as a fighter, as a baseball player, as a doctor, as anybody, that they understand that the first qualification and the most important one and the most important probably prerequisite to being a pro is doing what you have to do even when you don't necessarily feel like it. And he had that goal with him as an actor. He had picked that up. He had never used it in a physical domain before, but from a mental standpoint, in his domain, he embraced that. He understood that. And I realized, I said, you know, I thought only the fighters got credit for that. I said, no, it's consistent with anyone who reaches a level of success as a professional. They all understand that. They all bring that quality. They all bring that understanding. And as he started to learn, I let him do some sparring so he could walk in a fighter's shoes, understand the most important parts of it, the dimensions where, you know, you have to make choices, and they are your choices. You learn that they're not someone else's choices. Sometimes you think they're someone else's choice, just like in life and anything under pressure. You think, well, it's his choice whether or not I can exist and whether or not I can do this, whether or not I can get through this. No, it's your choice. It's not his choice. And he started to understand that he had control of that. And it served him to fill the role as a fighter, to look like a fighter, to walk like a fighter, to think like a fighter, to talk like a fighter, to feel like a fighter. And I realized that he had gotten the lessons down so well that we were training 4 hours a day at Gleason's gym, and he had been deteriorating, and I realized that he was sick, so I took him to the best doctor I knew, my father, and he had pneumonia. And he hadn't said anything because he was following the things that I laid out for him and that he understood from his professional. Do what you're supposed to do. And he was doing it. It's just that I was able to see there was something still a little wrong. He was doing fine, but I could see something wasn't, and it was my responsibility to act on that. It was his responsibility to keep going. I know that sounds like a little dangerous out there, but it truly is about being, you know, being a pro if you want to aspire to be a pro and be successful at that level. And so he was doing what he was supposed to do, and I did what I was supposed to do. I looked out for him. I saw something. I took him to a doctor, and sure enough, he had pneumonia. But again, it reinstated in my mind that a pro is a pro, whether he's got gloves on or whether he goes on a stage and puts makeup on and makes his living that way. A pro is a pro. And you have those qualities or you don't have them. You understand them or you will never understand them. And he understood them. And we went over to Poland to do this movie. We spent a month over there doing the movie. I did all the choreography, besides training him to look like a fighter for about 3 months. And we did all the choreography for the fight. And we had a funny story because there was one scene we were having a little trouble, and it was a stubborn, very famous Polish actor over there. And there was a little bit of an ego battle going on with Willem being the star and him being the big star over there. And he was supposed to have this fight. And he was a guard in the prison camp. And, you know, Willem was a prisoner. And he was supposed to have this fight, regular fight, you know, without gloves. And we had a little trouble, again, because of the language barrier and, of course, because of some stuff that was going on in the Eagles with this guy wanting to show that he was the man over in Poland and it shouldn't be Willem. And so Willem came back and he said he's not cooperating. He said, you know, we're trying to do this move. We worked on it for the last week, Teddy, and he's not cooperating. I said, well, there's this a universal way. He said, well, maybe it's because he doesn't speak and because he's from here and he thinks that I'm infringing. I said, yeah, that's part of it. I said, but don't worry about it. I said, there's a universal thing. He goes, there is? I said, yeah, there is. He goes, what is it? I said, it's a right hand. I said, the next one, I said, just hit him a right hand. I said, he goes, hit him? I said, yeah. I said, aim it a little bit like we've been doing for the shoulder, but, you know, you hit part of him. I said, believe me, it's a universal thing, and everything will be okay after that. He said, but what if I hurt him? I said, Willem, you're not that good a puncher. You know, I'm a decent teacher, but I'm not that good. You're not going to hurt him. He's about 70 pounds bigger than you. And just let it go. And he did. And the director's watching it, and he says, wow, that was a great take. He goes, that was great. He goes, that looked real. And all of a sudden, as the actor turned, he turned out to be a really nice guy. As he turned, there was blood coming out of his mouth. He goes, that's not blood, is it? And the director, you know, somebody said, yeah. He goes, Jesus, you know, that, you know, he got all excited and everything. And then Willem came over to me, and the actor came over, shook Willem's hand, and everything was good after that. I mean, it was, Willem said, you're right. It turned everything around. And from that moment on, there were no more language barriers. There were no more ego problems. There was no more disconnect. And we put a good fight scene together. And, you know, Willem, despite worrying about his power damaging somebody, didn't damage the guy that bad because he was fine. And he was able to continue after that. So it was different things that you go through and different stories you remember. But it turned out well.
Great. Well, Teddy, we have just a couple of questions before we lay off the line. And I wanted to ask, you trained so many great fighters in your career, but what do you consider to be your most satisfying experience that you've had being a trainer?
Well, probably Maine Moore and Gary Young, the two kids I talked about, you know, they never went on to be pro fighters. They were pretty good amateur fighters, but they overcame things inside themselves that without boxing, they probably never would have overcome and gone on to be successful the way they have as people. So those are two of them. And then Michael Moore winning the heavyweight title. You know, since I was a kid training fighters with Cuz, he always told me I'm going to have the heavyweight champ of the world, and all of a sudden it happens. And I had promised my kids that we would have the heavyweight title and they would get in the ring, and I was able to keep my word to them. After we won the title in Caesar's Palace, I was able to get them in the ring and have them share that with me. So that was, obviously, that's got to be up there, up in the top.
Yeah, and speaking of Michael Moore, you know, you trained him to become a two-time heavyweight champion, but you know, when you trained him for a certain fight, and that was the fight with Big George Foreman, certain things, he was doing everything perfectly in that fight, and it just came down to the 10th round, and we all know what happened. It made history. But what is your reflections on that fight all these years later?
No, I mean, you know, the thing that was most frustrating about that was I understood it was always going to come down to not getting knocked out, that otherwise we'd win a fight, that George wasn't going to outpoint us. And I understood the danger of George, even at the age he was at, that he was still what he represented, that the second George Foreman was much tougher than the first one. The second George Foreman, the second coming of George Foreman, would have knocked out the first George Foreman, even though the first George Foreman was younger and physically more able. Because the second George Foreman, after the Zaire fight, which he quit, you know, a lot of people say, oh, he didn't quit, Teddy got hit the right hand, he pirouetted around. He quit. He submitted. He was a conspirator to his own demise. He gave in. You know, he got bluffed by Ali. He got broken down by Ali. Again, he didn't understand that it was in his power. It was his choice to or not to. And he didn't understand that. And he gave in. But he spent 10 years exercising those ghosts and being tortured by those ghosts and realizing that he did have control that night, and he gave it up, and he had to live with it. And the couple more rounds of punches were not anything. It would have been over in a millisecond. In the blink of an eye, it would have been over. And that's people should understand that in everything in life, that, you know, in some ways, boxing is a metaphor for a lot of things in life. But George realized that it would have been done, and he would have handled it, and he could have handled it. And now he had to suffer because he didn't. And, you know, I knew he was dangerous because of that. I knew he brought that knowledge, that experience, that determination, that task, and that burden into the ring to make everything right. And we couldn't make a mistake with him. And every day in Palm Springs training camp at the Riviera Hotel where we trained, I would start and finish the workout by saying, listen, George has this thing where he tricks you with a jab. It doesn't really hit you. It doesn't do damage. He flicks it out there, flicks it out there, flicks it out there, flicks, and he makes you feel comfortable. And it's this experience. It's there's something behind it that's brilliant, that's planned. And he makes you feel comfortable. And he doesn't throw it all the way out. He throws about three quarters, so you feel like you're that range is the end of his punches. But it's not. There's another 4 inches before you're really out of danger. And he makes you feel like that range is okay. Nothing can hurt you in that range. You're safe. And once he gets you comfortable, he just throws a right hand right behind it. That doesn't look like much, but you never see it. It's right behind the jab. So the last thing that you see is the jab in your face and then nothing else. And I said, that's the most dangerous thing, that the best thing he does. And I said, we can't let ourselves lose because of that. Because I will have ghosts for years to carry around, and I don't feel like going through what George went through. And every day we would start, and it got to the point where Michael goes, I know, we have to do this again. I said, yeah, we got to do it again. I know, he throws a jab, he makes you think you're safe here, you don't worry about it, next thing you know, he hits you with the right hand. I said, yeah, let's go over it again. And we got hit with that punch. And that's the thing, that's my own little ghost, that, my God, you know, hit me with something I'm not ready for and something I'm not prepared for. I'd still be upset. I'd be upset I didn't prepare for it. But when you get my fighter with something that we prepared for and we understood and we knew about and you still do it, it's, you know, it sticks in your core and it's difficult. But I give all the credit in the world to both George and Michael. I give all the credit in the world to George for being more than a big guy, for being a smart guy, a guy who learned his lesson, a guy who steeled himself, a guy who changed himself, a guy who understood the truths from the lies, a guy who got better in age, and a guy who came there to make amends, to make things right, and to go through what he had to go through to do it, to use his experience and use his intellect to do it. And I give credit to Michael for being devastated by that moment, destroyed by that moment, and then coming back and winning the title again against Axel Schultz in Germany after that. So I give credit to both guys.
Yeah, now Teddy, continuing on just a little bit about that, you said the old George Foreman and the younger one, there was a difference in the fighters that they were. But I have to ask you, you guys won the title against Evander Holyfield, and then a few years later, you ended up rematching Evander, and there was a complete difference in the way those two fights went. He tells
I wasn't there for the rematch. I walked away. The rematch was an $8 million fight against Holyfield, and I warned Michael, I won't get into all the details, but I had warned Michael in camp before that fight with one of the title defenses against Vaughn Bean, I think. I warned him that if he didn't change a certain thing in his behavior and certain things in his living and his practice of things that he was doing and, you know, his thought pattern of things, that I would walk away from him. And I don't know if he didn't believe me or it was just a thing of stubbornness and wanting to do what he wanted to do and, you know, getting into the kind of battle with two people. But I meant what I said. And, you know, sometimes you got to put your money where your mouth is, unfortunately, even if it's, you know, even if it is a payday of that kind of magnitude that you have to walk away from. But he continued to do things that I didn't want him to do, and he didn't correct it, and I walked away from him. He wound up, getting Freddie Roach to train him for that fight, and he got knocked out by Holyfield in that rematch, you know, and I didn't talk to him for, I don't know how many years, 5 years. I wouldn't talk to him because, you know, I felt betrayed after what we've been through and what we've done together and the journey we took. I felt completely betrayed by him, and I had no use for him to talk to him. And it took many, many years. And one day I finally said, you know, because he would always try to call, I wouldn't talk to him. I wouldn't let him call the house. And finally one day I was on a plane going somewhere, and I said, you know, I don't have to do this, but as a human being, let me write him a letter and explain to him so he knows, he doesn't make himself the victim. He knows why I'm not talking to him. He knows where I feel betrayed and why I feel betrayed. And I wrote him a letter. It was a long letter. And after that, at some point, when I was away with ESPN, he wound up calling my house and knew I was away, talked to my wife, and he was crying. And he said he was in the truck reading this letter over and over and over again. And he realized what had happened and what he did, and he wanted to be able to get back together with me. And at some point after that, I wound up talking to him again.
All right. Well, you're currently training, a young heavyweight, Alexander Povetkin, and it is looking more and more likely that he will be facing Vladimir Klitschko next. David Haye, that fight does not seem like it will be coming together. If he does match up with, obviously if Povetkin matches up with Klitschko in September, how do you see that fight going?
Well, I mean, my kid's got 19 fights. Obviously, Klitschko, with his size, with the way he uses his size, with the confidence that he's gained, with the experience that he's gained being on that stage, having been successful on that kind of stage, it's going to be a difficult task. It's going to be if it didn't happen right away and we got a chance to get a few more fights, I wouldn't be against that. But if it's going to happen that way, I'll do everything to prepare my fighter to win that fight. And it will be about understanding exactly what the fight plan should be and needs to be, and then having the discipline to execute it. And I do understand what that fight plan needs to be, and I would obviously have to make sure my fighter understood that.
All right. Well, finally, Teddy, is there anything you want to say to all the boxing fans out there?
Yeah, I don't know. The only thing, I don't go on the internet, really. I don't understand too much about it. I don't know how to turn a computer on. I don't go on there. And sometimes I think there's people that run these websites that are not responsible. They don't have the background. They don't have the responsibility to really run a website for the right reasons and in a responsible way. But there are people like you guys that do. And those ones I applaud, because you give another outlet to the fans. And I think the fight fans, they're some of the real ones, the ones that are open-minded and just not, trying to come lately for a second, but have open minds that just aren't saying, if you say something against my fighter, then you're wrong. But they will listen, and they will allow their intellect to be there, not just their heart, but their heart to be there too. But I think those fans are some of the great fans in any sport at all. And I wish we could put good fights on for you all the time. I think sometimes we could do a better job. And I for my part, I would do anything I could to put the best fights on for you. And to just hopefully I'm doing something that's worthwhile, and trying to be honest with you every week, and trying to present the bouts and present what's going on in the ring and outside the ring in the most straightforward way, and in a way that maybe explains something that maybe in some way wasn't understood before. And I appreciate all of you. I appreciate your loyalty to watching the fights, to watching Friday night fights in particular on ESPN, even when sometimes we don't have the best fights, but our intentions are to put the best fights on. And I appreciate you guys staying with us. I appreciate that you guys care about the sport, and most importantly, that you care about the participants of the sport. Because a lot of times you just come up to me in airports and you say, thank you for trying to protect a fighter. So I would say, and caring about the sport. So I would say, thank you for recognizing that I am trying to do that. I might not always do the best job, but I'm trying to do that. And I would say, thank you for recognizing that, and thank you for caring about those things.
All right. Well, we certainly appreciate that, Teddy, and we definitely appreciate the time you spent with us. It was a pleasure getting all your stories and insight in the world of boxing. And all I can say is we just wish you the best of luck in your future, and we thank you again for your time.
Good luck to you guys, too.
Thank you very much, Teddy.
You're welcome, Jeffrey.
All right, everybody, that was Teddy Atlas. And you know what? Man, if you want stories and history of this game, man, you go to this guy here. He's trained some of the best fighters out there. And, you know, he's a wealth of knowledge, and some of the stuff that he's done in his career, it's great to hear. It was great to get that perspective. Rami, what are your thoughts on what Teddy had to say?
Well, as I said during the interview, Jenna, I was happy. Personally, for me, it was a pleasure to interview Teddy because I've heard so much about his father, who was my father's family doctor when they were growing up on Staten Island. And to be able to, it's one of those interviews that my father and a lot of members of his family were hoping I'd get for a long time. I had read Teddy's book, which I thought was very good. And it was great for me to get to hear his insight. I mean, I'm a big fan of Teddy. I like his work on Friday Night Fights every week. I think he does have an interesting way of bringing points across and bringing the fights to the fan in an enjoyable way. I think he's great at that, and it's something that I really appreciate. So to have the opportunity to have such a lengthy discussion with Teddy Atlas, it was a privilege.
Yeah, it certainly was, and it was a great pleasure to have that. Nick Powers, what are your thoughts on it?
Wow. I mean, Teddy's just general. Like you said, Teddy's got stories for days, and he's one of those people that you could listen to talk all day. And it wasn't even just about some of the fighters he worked with. Some of the great stuff that I took from that interview was the stories he had about when he was training the kids and made them bring their report cards in, and the kid who had the hair lip and who had the cleft palate on his lip and started doing a lot better in school after Teddy started working with him. Like, that's some of the great stuff that I feel like we don't hear or see enough of in the sport today. I think that that's something that may have been lost in translation a little bit as the generations came along, but we are seeing a little bit of it nowadays. I mean, Floyd Mayweather has the young kids in his gym and things like that, but that's definitely a lot of stuff that I think, if it is out there more than we imagine, I'd like to see it publicized a bit more, and I'm sure Teddy would as well, because as he said at the end, he's always trying to protect fighters, and he's just trying to be as uncorrupt as he can be in a sport that many people recognize as being one that isn't necessarily on the upswing as far as being fair, it seems. But Teddy was an outstanding interview. To hear some of his perspectives on so many great things that he did during his career, his relationship with Michael Moore, what he thinks of Alexander Povetkin, and actually hear him say that he came back to train Povetkin based on Povetkin's respect and the fact that he felt that he was somebody he could show something to, I think speaks volumes about Povetkin himself. I think that the fact that Teddy Atlas came back after admittingly saying he didn't want to be in the gym anymore speaks volumes about what he thinks of Povetkin as both a person and a fighter. So I thought it was an absolutely outstanding interview, and it surely didn't even feel as long as it actually was, because it was pretty smooth and it was great, and I would love to have Teddy back again.
Yeah, there's just so many things you could talk to Teddy about. I mean, you know, training with Costamato, I mean, you know, his stories of Mike Tyson, you know, and even trained Michael Grant a little bit back then, what it was like trying to get him in there and what happened there. And Donnie LaDame back in the day, when he actually became the light heavyweight champion. So there's so many things you could talk to Teddy about. You could talk to him three or four more times and still not get the whole story. So, you know, it really was great to get him on here, and I can't wait to get him again. But anyways, guys, to change things up a little bit, and something that was actually kind of interesting this past week is that Yuri Foreman, everyone saw the fight with Miguel Cotto. He was injured. He hurt his knee. People were wondering how bad the damage was. It was bad enough that he needed surgery. He did undergo successful right knee surgery. And I'll go over to you, Nick Powers. How'd that all go?
Well, Yuri Foreman did undergo successful surgery on his knee to fix both a torn ACL and a meniscus tear that he suffered in the Cotto fight. It actually, when he mentioned in the post-fight interview wearing that brace on his knee that it was an old injury, apparently he has had a torn ACL in his knee since he was 15 years old, which is pretty astounding to me, because that's a serious injury. It's one that I suffered myself, and when it first happened to me, I could barely walk, and I definitely didn't have as much mobility in my legs as I did when it wasn't torn up, for obvious reasons. And even now, after I had surgery to fix it, it still bothers me sometimes. And the fact that he was able to be the kind of fighter and have this sort of mobility and footwork in the ring, having that injury for so long, is really just insane. But when he slipped in the seventh round, he did end up tearing his meniscus. But the surgery was about an hour and a half, and Dr. Laith Jaswari performed it on him. and he said that his boxing game is definitely going to be improved, and he'll be back in about 6 months with a stable knee and with a lot more mobility. So that's definitely a good look for Yuri Foreman. It's good that he actually underwent the surgery and didn't think that it was just something he could maybe, you know, wear a brace on his knee and kind of set aside, as apparently he did with the ACL injury. But, yeah, he got an MRI done, and it showed that he did have an ACL tear with the old injury and the meniscus tear he did suffer in the Cotto fight. And that's, once again, a testament to Yuri's character as well, because that's a pretty serious injury as well, that one that absolutely hinders your mobility, your ability to use your legs. And the fact that he continued in the Cotto fight and was down to fight for as long as he did with both of those injuries is really, really good for him, and it shows that he has a lot of heart. But he underwent successful surgery, his knee's recovering, and if he should be coming back in about 6 months, that's what the doctor said, and they said he'll be coming back even better than ever.
Nice. That's great to hear. You want to see him back in the ring. He fought his heart out against Miguel Cotto. Even with bad knee, he kept trying. And he earned some new fans, people that weren't a fan of his style and the things that he did in the ring. They saw a different side to him. They saw the heart, the will to be a fighter. And you know what? HBO started too, so I think we'll be seeing him again. I think it's what the recent news came out there. HBO wants him back, and it's all great to hear. See him in 6 months, hopefully. Hopefully he gets a little bit more pop after the knee surgery. Be very interesting to see. But anyways, guys, we're going to take a short break, and we'll be back with Team Rockman. Everybody, we are back with former heavyweight champion Haseem "The Rock" Rockman. How's it going today, Haseem?
I'm good. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. We're happy to have you on the show. I'd first like to ask you, you're training for your upcoming fight against Shannon Miller. How's it going?
Everything is going on schedule. I feel good. I feel strong. I feel fast. I just feel like, you know, it's time to come to Niagara Falls and put on a good performance.
All right. Now, you took a long period of time out of the ring after your loss to Vladimir Klitschko. You recently came back in March against, you fought a guy, it was a journeyman, but it was good just to get back in the ring. But what was the main reason for taking such a long period of time off?
Well, I needed some rest. And I had some injuries. I had to get a surgery, and I had to rehab two parts of my body. So I've done that successfully, and I'm back. I feel better and stronger than ever.
All right. So what do you expect from your opponent, Shannon Miller?
Well, I expect him to come out aggressively and try to win the fight.
All right. So, Haseem, now if you're looking at the heavyweight picture, where do you see yourself in the mix?
I still feel as though I'm one of the strongest heavyweights out, even now. You've got a heavyweight champion that's right now older than I am, so that motivates me. Let me know that, you know, I'm not past my prime. I feel like, you know, I can still do this. I feel like one shot for me, the right shot for me, will put anybody to sleep. So I'm encouraged.
All right, now you're the last guy to be the linear heavyweight champion from America when you defeated Lennox Lewis. In the previous years, you won the title back again, and it's been a little bit up and down in your career since then. Can you explain to the people out there why you think that is?
It's always been up and down in my career from day one. From day one, I was told that I was too old to come in the gym. I was 20 years old when I walked in the gym. He told me I didn't have enough amateur experience. I had 10 amateur fights. Then I rose to the pinnacle of the sport. Then you know, I feel like I got complacent, and complacency set in on me, and it's been like an up and down thing for me, because I will look at a fighter sort of like this. It's really, really a dangerous fight for me, because the risk reward really is not there for me. But I would look at a fighter, and on paper I would say that this guy can't beat me, and it would be the best version of me that I would compare myself to. But then I would send a less than stellar version of myself in there, and guys would get a win over me. So, you know, it's just been like a process over and over, where as though I feel these guys can't beat me. And now I may take a shortcut here and there, and they, you know, turn up and pull off a shocker.
All right. Well, speaking of shock, let's talk about the ultimate high point in your career. That's when you fought Lennox Lewis. Nobody gave you a chance. You were a 10-1 underdog by most bookmakers. You went to South Africa, and I was actually watching that fight live. And you know what? It was a very long time back, but I can remember Lennox Lewis giving you a big smile, and all of a sudden you landed that big right hand on him.
Can
you tell us what that experience
smile.
Was like? Huh?
Oh, it was absolutely like it's indescribable with that. It's nothing that I can make an analogy and give you. It's like, you know, it's like a dream come true. You fighting on the biggest stage and doing everything that you're supposed to do and taking all the necessary steps and going over to South Africa a month ahead of time and just preparing. You know, you got a huge champion that's hugely popular, and really looking at me like, okay, well, I'm going to just go over here. This guy's just in my way right now. I'm going to go over there and knock him out. And then to knock him out, to win the fight is one thing, but to knock him out in emphatic fashion like I did was just unbelievable.
Yeah, it certainly was. Now, after that fight, there was a lot of talk about you going in a different direction. You obviously had a contract to sign for a rematch with Lennox Lewis. He had a rematch clause. But what was there to the rumors of you possibly facing Mike Tyson back then?
Well, it was very real possibility. I could have taken the fight before that, but then I wound up signing a contract with Don King, and instead of me putting Lennox second in the fight, he would wind up being third, and then we wound up going to court, and the judge ruled that I had to fight Lennox right away.
All right, now you fought that rematch, you went right in there. Can you tell us what was so different the second time around?
I got cocky. I felt like, you know, that he's not recovered from what I did to him in South Africa. Mentally, I didn't think he was recovered. And then we had a tussle, actually, ahead of in the press conference, build up to the fight, and it was on ESPN, and we wound up physically tussling. I just felt like I felt like I could just manhandle him. I wound up throwing him onto the ground. We wound up wrecking ESPN stage set, and his bodyguard was trying to hold me back. So I not only threw him on the ground, but I had his bodyguard trying to stop me, and he couldn't stop me. So I just felt like, you know, that I'm too strong for this man. I just felt like there's nothing he can do with me. I'm just too strong for him. And I got extremely big-headed because of
him. Yeah, now, watching that fight, though, it appeared between rounds that your corner gave you some bad advice that led to the knockout. Can you tell us what happened there?
I don't know. I mean, my corner was really – my corner wouldn't have been my corner, but I had loaned my trainer like $300,000 before the fight, so it was not like I couldn't fire him, but he was not my trainer. I mean, he wasn't really doing anything the whole time in preparation. And then that fight night, he really didn't prepare me for the fight anyway, because he had another fighter on the card who had fought right before me, which was a friend of mine, William Jobby. He fought right before me, And then he came back and tried to rush and get me in the ring. So it was like, this is not what you do when you got the heavyweight champion of the world and you fighting for the biggest prize in sports. So, I mean, you forsake any other fighters on the card, especially right before the main event. But, I mean, it is what it is. So, I don't really feel like I had a trainer in that fight.
All right. Well, I'm seeing Ross and joined by my co-host, Jeff Ciani. Jeff?
Hi, Hussein. It's a pleasure to have you on the show, champ.
Good to be here, Jeff.
Good to hear. It's our pleasure. Hussein, after you lost the belt to Lewis in the rematch, you had a string of tough fights there that started with Evander Holyfield, and it was a competitive fight you were having with Holyfield, and the fight was obviously stopped when a headbutt, I guess, it caused that grotesque swelling on your head. I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that fight and about how you felt about the way it had ended and how you felt you were doing in that fight.
Well, I only had one thing to say about that fight, and I hope this sums it up for you, that Evander Holyfield fought a very intelligent fight. He used his head very well.
Okay. Now, follow it.
That sums it up for you pretty good?
Pretty good, yeah, I'd say.
Okay.
Now, in your next fight after that, you had a rematch with David Tua. I think you came in a career high in weight for that fight, but to the surprise of many people and a lot of outside observers, despite that fight being ruled a draw, you were actually, most ringside observers that I'd spoken to thought that you had won the fight. Did you feel you won the rematch with Tua, and can you tell us a little bit about that one?
Actually, I'm going to take you back a little further. I felt like I beat David Tua two times just to have no wins over him officially on my record. But I knocked him down for the first time in his career. That they didn't really count. And I outboxed him. I set counter box records on the number of jabs I was hitting him with, connecting with. It was an easy fight. David Tua is somebody who I really believe I just have his number. The weight wasn't a fact. I was strong. I was conditioned, and people didn't give me a chance. So I feel like that's when I'm at my best, when people think that I have no shot.
Now, Steve, you had those two, what I would describe as, they had to be very frustrating fights in a row there. And then after that, you went up against a guy that was arguably one of the most frustrating guys out there in the sport, in John Ruiz. And I'm wondering, at the end, a little bit about the Ruiz fight, if you could touch on that, but I'm wondering how you felt after having three fights like that in a row where, you know, things weren't looking good for you, but you managed to bounce back after that and get your career back on track. But how were you feeling during that time?
Well, you know, I look at boxing, and I looked at, in the olden days when Ken Norton and Muhammad Ali and all these guys were fighting, that's all they fought was tough fights. And they didn't always win all the tough fights, but they were respected for fighting the tough fights. And I'm a guy that, you know, it don't really matter who I fight. I mean, I'll fight a guy that you may perceive me to walk in there and knock him out. Well, I'll fight a guy who nobody else wants to fight. Myself, and at the time, Chris Bird was arguably the most feared or most ducked heavyweight at the time. I went to Don King, Chris came to Don King, we tried to put it together. I was never a guy that, like, was afraid to fight anybody, and it really didn't matter to me what happened in the fight. I mean, I'm going to come in there, and as long as I come in there and give my all, I'm fine with it. I mean, I've never been afraid of anything. Everything in my life before boxing was much harder than boxing, so why would I be afraid of one man?
Great. Changing things up here a tiny bit, Hussein. One of the questions I like to ask the guests we have on the show is about the origin of their nicknames, and I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about the story when you first started using the nickname The Rock.
My last name is actually pronounced Rockman, So it was kind of shortened version of Rockman. And also, I mean, when I was putting them, I was letting them things go on them guys, it was looking like I was hitting them with rocks and bricks. So I guess, you know, they settled on rock.
All right. Now, Haseem, going back to the current heavyweight division, I want to get your perspective on that. What do you think of the two of the champions, which is Vladimir and Vitaly Klitschko, and also the emergence of David Haye?
Well, I mean, I really can't say anything bad about the Klitschko's. They beating everybody you put in front of them. I don't think that the American public really is too enthusiastic about it because they safety first, but they winning. And David Haye would be somebody that America, I believe, will fall in love with if he came over here and fought, because he takes a bit more chance and pretty much all his fights end in knockouts. So I believe it's a lot of potential there. I mean, but these guys need to fight each other. You know, I mean, obviously Vladimir and Vitaly is not going to fight each other, but David Haye need to fight one, or if not both, of the Klitschko's, and let's just get one champion. We got one world. Let's have one world champion.
All right. Now, speaking of Vitaly Klitschko, that was a guy that you were matched up to fight with quite a few times, and each time the fight was canceled, he got hurt, he got injured. You know, how disappointed were you that you never got in the ring with him?
Well, I was extremely disappointed at the time, but I feel like, you know, if something get taken away from me, I feel like something equal or better will come my way. So I don't really focus too much on the door that's closing on me, because I might miss the door that's opening. So I just look for something better coming my way.
All right. Well, thankfully you're in the heavyweight division. That's where age seems to be more extended than anywhere else. You got David Tua out there. You got Shannon Briggs. You got yourself. You have many guys that are, you know, a little bit in the upper 30s that are still very competitive. What do you think about the heavyweight division and its longevity that it provides you?
Well, the thing about the heavyweights, I believe that we're able to go longer because we don't really have to strain our body to make this certain weight. I mean, if we come in 220, that's fine. If we come in 230, 240, 250, it's no real strain on our body as opposed to somebody having to come down from 180 to 135 or 140. And I mean, it's just a vicious strain on your body, wear and tear over and over and over and over through the years. But with the heavyweights, it's really non-existent. So I just feel like that's a plus for us, and that enables us to have a longer career.
Great. Well, Haseem, we're also joined by my co-host, Nick Powers. Nick?
Hey, Haseem, great to speak with you. It's a pleasure to have you on the ropes for the first time. The first question I wanted to ask you is, being that we're on the subject of the Klitschko's and the heavyweight division as a whole, you touched briefly on some of the longevity of some of the heavyweight fighters, the older fighters like yourself and some others that Jenna mentioned, but I was curious as to what your thoughts are on some of the younger heavyweights. We just had Teddy Atlas on, and he was, of course, talking about Alexander Povetkin, who he's now training and who looks to be fighting Klitschko. What do you think about Povetkin and some of the other younger fighters in the heavyweight division?
Well, I mean, I'm not really sure of the emergence of any other real competitive young heavyweight. And I believe that if it was a lot more Povetkin that was on the rise, then I think, you know, you would be hearing less from myself and David Tua and Shannon Briggs. But Povetkin is definitely a really, really good fighter. I mean, he's an Olympic gold medalist. I believe he's the real deal. I give him a shot to be any heavyweight out here.
Great. Now, switching up subjects a little bit, we've seen a lot of boxers, former champion boxers, switch over to the world of mixed martial arts. James Toney, of course, being the most notable, and he's about to fight in August. But you actually previously
James
showed some
Toney,
interest in going over
James
to the world
Toney.
Of MMA. What prompted that?
Actually, that was just rumors. I never was interested in MMA. And I'm correct you a little bit. His name is James Toney, and he will probably get crushed in his MMA debut.
Haseem, I was wondering, do you watch a lot of boxing, and who are some of the fighters out there today that you most enjoy watching?
Actually, I do watch a lot of boxing. I like pretty much. I like Floyd Mayweather, Manny Pacquiao. I hope they make that fight. I like Paul Williams. I like Cotto. I like Chad Dawson. I like. I mean, it's a host of fighters I like. I like some of the Gamboa. I like Juan Manuel, Puerto Rican champion, Lopez.
Lopez,
I definitely like watching boxing.
Now, you mentioned Pacquiao and Mayweather, and that really is the fight that everybody wants to see and everybody is hoping will get made. A, do you think the fight will get made? And B, if it does, how do you see it playing out, Haseem?
Well, let me answer A first. No, I don't think it's going to get made. So do you still need me to answer B?
Well, yeah, I do still want you to answer B. But I guess I'll throw in a C there or an A and a half and say, why do you think it won't happen? And if it did happen, how do you see it playing out?
Okay. Well, B, I see Floyd winning a decision in the fight. I don't think he'll really take the chances. Floyd's an excellent boxer and an excellent defensive boxer. I really don't see him taking the chances and really, really getting it. I don't think it'll be a terribly exciting fight, but I think Floyd is clever enough in the ring. He's smart enough in the ring to not get caught by any of those huge shots by Pacquiao. I believe that Pacquiao is the more exciting fighter, but Floyd is the better boxer. Floyd is the smarter boxer in the ring, and I just think he'll use his vast amount of skills to stay out of harm's way and cruise his way to a unanimous decision. And C or A and a half or whatever, however you named it, I just don't think that Floyd believes that Manny is a clean fighter because, I just feel like he think he went, you know, from ordinary to extraordinary. And I've been at Manny Pacquiao's fights with Floyd. We were at the Eric Morales fight together. So, Manny looks like an entirely different fighter. So I just think that's on Floyd's mind, and if Manny doesn't want to take the drug test, I just don't see Floyd, you know, getting in there. And I mean, it's not about the 14-day cutoff. I believe that they want. I mean, I think that the problem is going to be that they want unlimited. You know, just the same test that Shane just took. I think Floyd's going to insist on that, and that's just my personal opinion.
All right. Now, Haseem, going back to something you brought up, you called James Toney James Phoney. You had two fights with him. Both had a little bit of controversy in each one of them. What are your opinions on those fights and of the man himself?
What are my opinions on what?
James Toney and your two fights you had with him.
Oh, well, you know, the first fight, I clearly thought I beat him in Atlanta City, but I had, you know, a mountain of people against me. He had Don King, he had Joe Goose, and he had Al Heyman. He had the Dax Decks against me. James Toney, in my opinion, is just a fraud. I mean, he can box. He's a heck of a boxer, Hall of Famer. But I just figure he's less than a man because, you know, he's like one of those guys who get on a show like this and he'll talk all kinds of trash, and then when he get in my face, he didn't want to speak and shake hands and hug. I slapped him in Cancun, and the next day he come shake my hand, told me I'm a good champ. Good luck to me. Him and I, we the best fighters, and you know you can't slap me and then get a handshake the next day. You know, I mean, and I really can't really see what man you can slap and then he want to be buddy-buddy with you. So, I mean, but then when he gets back to America and he get on internet site, it's old tough James Toney again. So to me, he's just a fraudulent man.
All right. Well, your last bout, you weighed in at 264 pounds. That was a career high. Where do you see yourself coming in for this fight?
Well, I'll be in. I think I'm gonna hit the 40s for this fight.
All right. Well, you know what? We have just a few more.
Then after that, I'll be back down to the 30s and ready to make a really, really, really strong one.
Yeah, and that's what I wanted to ask you. How many fights do you think you're gonna need to get into the title picture?
July. I will be in the 235, 237 range, and then from there it's like, you know, whoever.
Whoever. All right. Well, I have just a few more questions, and we have one from our chat room here, and they wanted to ask you, what was it with your two fights with Oleg Moskayev? And they're pretty adamant they wanted this one answered here, but what was it about Oleg that he just seemed to have your number in those two fights?
I really could not answer that. I've knocked out guys cold in the gym that knocked him out. So I just don't get it. I just do not get that. There's nothing I can say that nothing could tell me this guy can beat me. I mean, I still don't think he's a better fighter than me, but I just don't know. I'm dumbfounded about that one. I can't figure that one out.
Yeah, well, when you won the title back, it shocked a lot of people that you lost to him a second time. What happened in the second bout?
I'm still, my answer for the answer I just gave you is the same answer. I don't know what it is about him. I don't know. I still haven't figured it out. If I fought him again for some strange reason, he would probably win.
All right, well, I have just two more questions. One is, you said you'd fight anyone out there in the heavyweight division, but let's say you win this coming weekend, which I've seen Shannon Miller before, you should knock him out. How soon do you see yourself getting back after that?
July.
July? All right. And finally, is there anything you want to say to all the boxing fans out there and your fans?
Well, I just want to, you know, just know that I'm giving this a serious run. I'm not just, you know, wasting their time or my time. I really feel like I'm gonna give this a serious run, and I will be in a significant fight this year.
All right. Well, Seem, it was an absolute pleasure having you on the show. We wish you the best of luck on the 19th and after that.
Okay, well, have me back after I dispose of Mr. Miller.
Hey, you got it, Haseem. It was a pleasure talking to you, man.
Thank you, Haseem. Good luck.
Thank you.
All right, everybody, that was Haseem, the Rock Rockman. Man, if you look at his resume and the people he's fought, it's, you know what, there's not many that can match it there. I mean, he's fought just about everyone in the heavyweight division. So many names, so many all-time greats. And you know what? Hey, man. He's honest about himself, what he thought right there. He talked a little bit about Oleg Moskayev. He said, hey, if you fight him a third time, something about the guy. You know what? He might beat him a third time. It's just some guys, I guess maybe you have your number, but it was an absolute pleasure talking to him. Rummy, what'd you think?
Yeah, Haseem seemed like a really cool guy, and I'm glad to have gotten the opportunity to speak with him. And one thing about Haseem's career in particular that nobody could ever take away from him, and I see a lot of fans say, you know, this and that about Haseem, saying he's the Buster Douglas of his generation or whatnot. I believe Lennox Lewis himself had often claimed that. But he beat Lennox Lewis at a time when Lennox Lewis was considered to be more or less an unstoppable force. He was the man in the division. And, you know, whether Lennox didn't prepare as well as he should have or anything like that, none of that has any bearing on the fact that Rockman went in the ring that night, did what he had to do, and he beat the man in the heavyweight division that night, which made him the man. And that's one thing about his career that nobody can ever take away from him. And it was a pleasure to speak to Haseem. I really did like hearing about some of the specifics from some of his fights he had. And he was a pretty, straightforward guy. He said what he believed, and then I always respect that kind of attitude from our guests. And, you know, it's interesting, Jenna, I think that this was the 10th heavyweight champion we've had on in OTR history. So that makes Haseem Rahman a special guest on that regard, and it was a pleasure to speak with him. I'd love to have him on again sometime.
Yeah, no, certainly. After he takes care of Mr. Miller, I think we definitely have to have him back there. I love that line, James Tony. You don't got no love for James Tony, but I'm going to go over to you, Nick Powers. What do you think?
Well, I got to echo Romy's sentiments once again. Haseem seemed like a pretty cool, pretty laid-back guy. And the one thing I noticed about him was that, like some of the other older heavyweights that have been around, most recently Shannon Briggs, who we had on, he seems like he's really trying to make another serious run at this at an older age, especially considering that he has a fight coming up and then said that he wants to get back in the ring as early as July. Shannon's had 3 fights within the course of, I think, 6 weeks, of course, including his last fight that was a few weeks ago. So it really seems like he's trying to stay dedicated and trying to stay in the gym to really give this maybe one more shot. And I wouldn't be hard-pressed to say maybe we put Shannon Briggs and Haseem Rahman in there against each other. I mean, the two never fought each other when they were both in their primes coming up or at any point of their careers. So if they're both trying to stay active and doing these one-a-month fights to try and stay in the public eye and keep themselves in good shape, why not put them in against each other?
Yeah, hey, you know, I was actually just about to suggest that they put a couple of OTR guests in there, both come back in heavyweights, both got some big pop. That fight, you can call it one thing, fireworks. Man, someone's going down in that fight. That ain't going the distance. It was an absolute pleasure, though, having them on. Anyways, guys, to change things up and change things up from our guests and past week's boxing, this upcoming weekend, there are some damn interesting fights. Now, there's one with Andre Ward and Alan Green. It's part of the Super 6. I've been looking forward to this one for quite a while. We haven't seen a Super 6 fight since April. It's now June, so let's see what we have here. We have, you know, obviously we have Green's coming off a win against Tarvis Sims, and then we have Ward who's coming off again against Miguel Kessler. I just can't wait for this fight, man. It's not a pick-up, it's not anything like that. I think Andre Ward's going to win this fight easy. I'm just looking forward to it, seeing these guys get back in there. Rummy, what are your thoughts on this one?
Well, I think that Andre Ward is going to win, and I think he's going to win handily. And on last week's program, he said to us here at OTR that, you know, that Green recently questioned his heart, and he thinks that it should really be the other way around, that Green should be questioning his own heart. And he went on to say that he's going to try to take Alan Green someplace that he's never been before and take him into deep waters. And Ward basically stressed the importance of mental strength in this fight coming into this one, and I honestly think that's exactly how it's going to play out, and I think that the difference in mental strength favors Ward, and I think the physical skill ability favors Ward. I think that this is going to be a very good win for Andre Ward. I think he is going to take Alan Green into deep waters. I think he's going to take him someplace he's never been before, and I think he's going to break him down mentally to the point where he's not really going to want to fight and be in there, and I suspect it'll be stopped inside the distance. I'm thinking it'll be sometime late inside the distance, though. I'm thinking that Alan Green makes it somehow or another to the 10th or 11th round before succumbing to the mental strength and the physical ability of Andre Ward, and I truly believe, and I could be wrong, and I've been wrong often enough in recent weeks on fight predictions and whatnot, but in my opinion, for what that is worth, I believe that Andre Ward is a superstar in the making, and I believe that when this Super 6 is all said and done, he'll be the last man standing, and I think that he'll match up very favorably against Alan Green, and I think that Ward wins this one. If I had to be forced for a round, I'll say TKO 11.
All right. Pretty bold there picking the KO. I'm picking this one to go the distance here. I've seen Alan Green fight quite a few times, and you know what? There's always, it seems to be just something missing there in his performance. You look at his fight against Tarvis Sims, you know, he just looks like he could just do a little bit more in there. And I hope that this fight here, he's in the best shape, the best condition, the best prepared that he's ever been, because you're not going to get a bigger opportunity than this right now. I mean, he's fighting Andre Ward, his popularity couldn't be any higher after what he did to Miguel Kessler. He's the guy right now at 168 pounds. He is favored to win the Super 6. This is a chance of a lifetime here, and I think we will see the best Alan Green, and I think it will go the distance. I think Ward will win handily, somewhere around 9 rounds to 3, 8 rounds to 4, something around those things right there. I believe Alan Green is going to give the best fight of his career and make it interesting. You know, from what I've seen and what I've seen in his training camp there, he's ready, he's focused. Some of those bad habits he had looking down at the floor, I think he's broken that, and it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. It's also interesting to see how Ward comes back from that knee injury there. He says he's 100% back. You never know with knee injuries. It'll be a little curious there, but I still pick him Ward by unanimous decision. Nick Powers, how do you see it?
Well, you know, both of you guys have very, very differing opinions on this, and I have to say, I think I'm siding with Rummy on this one. The more I think about this fight, in the early goings, I thought that Alan Green was definitely going to pose a decent problem for Andre Ward. When I saw him fight live against Carlos De Leon Jr. back in April 2009, he won in two rounds, and he looked very, very impressive, and he looked pretty good in the Tarvis Sims fight as well. But the more I think about it, something about Alan Green, Jenna, like you mentioned, in some of his fights, it doesn't seem like everything's there. It seems like he's missing something. He's not the most humble guy in the world. He talks a decent bit of smack, and he kind of has an attitude that comes off as saying, man, come on, this guy's got nothing against me. I'm going to make him look like an idiot, like a fool when I get in there. And he has the same kind of attitude about going in there against Andre Ward, especially being that this is his first fight in the tournament, and he basically needs 3 points, I believe, if he wants to try and move on to the second part of the tournament. So he's going to be gunning for the knockout in this fight. And the more I think about it, I just don't think that Andre Ward is going to let him break him. I think that, just like Rummy said, Andre Ward has a much better mental capacity, much more mental toughness than Alan Green does. And the more I think about it, I just really think that Andre Ward really is going to take him into deep water and is going to probably make him look like a fool. I mean, that's kind of a bold statement maybe to make, but something I just don't really think that Alan Green sold me on everything that he says yet. I haven't seen that many things from him that are that impressive. So if I had to pick around, I'd actually pick Andre Ward to probably win it in 9. I'm thinking that he's actually going to come out and use his usual, you know, controlled pace, some of the stuff he did against Kessler, but I think that he's going to start to turn it up a little bit more when Alan Green realizes that he doesn't have anything in his arsenal to really deter Andre Ward from the game plan and from the mindset that he has going into that fight. He's probably going to break, and I think that Ward, whether or not he KOs him or the corner stops him, is going to win it inside 9 rounds.
All right, guys. Both kicking the can here. I just don't see it here. Maybe I'm wrong. You know, I've been right a lot, though, lately, so I don't know. You can take a look at my V-cash over at Eastside Boxing, the richest person there. That I don't know. I've been predicting these things right here. I'm going to be putting all of it on Andre Ward. That's one thing for sure. He's going to be winning this fight. There's no doubt in my mind here. There's something wrong if you don't, but I still think it's going to be a good match, and I just see it going the distance. Anyways, guys, switching things up, there's another fight that's coming, not this weekend, but actually coming tomorrow, and that will be with former guest Oliver McCall facing Timur Ibragimov. Now, why I find this fight so interesting is because it's kind of a crossroads fight in a sense. Timur Ibragimov is trying to work his way up to the, you know, to the upper echelon there and possibly get a title shot. But you have Oliver McCall here. He's on his, you know, basically towards the end of his career here. He's looking for that one last shot. So both guys need this fight. They both need this win. McCall's had a little bit of trouble outside the ring. He's getting back in there. His first fight in October. It's his toughest fight since he made his comeback. I'm actually really looking forward to this fight. I, you know, unfortunately, there's no TV broadcast for it, but I'm actually looking forward because I actually used to love watching Oliver McCall fight. He's older. He's one of those older, cagey guys. And, you know, I just think it's very interesting here, but I'm actually going to pick the upset here. I'm taking Oliver McCall. I say he's got, you know what they say, every old fighter has one great fight left in him. He's 45 years old. I believe he can do this. I believe he can get this win. I think it'll be very close. I'm taking him by split decision. I'm going to go over to you, Rummy. How do you see it?
Well, I got to echo a lot of your sentiments here, Jenna. One, I'm very actually interested in this fight, and I wish that it was being televised tomorrow because I think it's a very interesting matchup, and I, too, always like watching McCall fight, and I think I'm going to go with the upset in this one, too, and say some way, somehow, one way or another, Oliver McCall is going to find a way to beat Timur Ibragimov. I don't know how much faith I have in that actually playing out, but that's the prediction I'm going with here, and it will be interesting to see because, you know, this is kind of, in a way, a bit of a crossroads fight for both of these guys where the winner should be in line for a step up and to keep his career on the right track, and the loser might really have no place to go after this. I think that it is a fight that McCall can win. I know McCall's had some problems and some issues lately in his personal life, but I think that it's a fight that he could win, and I think with a guy like McCall with his chin and his power, he always could be an interesting player amongst the heavyweight landscape, especially these days.
Yeah, one thing McCall is known for, it's one of the greatest chins in heavyweight boxing. So unless he's completely lost in that ability to take a punch, this fight is going the distance. Timur Ibragimov can actually take a pretty good shot. But one thing, if you want to see a telltale sign that a guy has a little bit left, His last fight, he won a split decision from Lance Whitaker. Lance Whitaker just fought this past weekend and pulled an upset against a highly touted prospect in the heavyweight division. So you know what? Apparently Oliver does have something left if he beat the guy, beat someone that was, you know what, on the way up. So I think Oliver has this one here. I believe he can do it. Timur seems to always, I don't know, is it just not rise to the occasion in these bigger fights. He didn't do anything against Brock. He did absolutely nothing against Tony Thompson. And you know what? I just think he's just cagey enough. I think he'll just find a way to win this fight. And you know what? He'll get that one last significant fight. I don't know if it'll be a title shot or anything like that, but I see McCall winning this fight and getting one more significant fight before it's all said and done. Nick Powers, you got any opinions on this one?
I do, and they're similar to both of you guys. As I think it's going to be even across the board. I'm picking McCall, too, because the one thing I always remember about the interview that we had with him when he was on the ropes a decent bit ago was he was one of the people who, when I first heard he was coming on, I said, okay, he's an older guy. He's still fighting. I don't see why. He's probably not going to do anything. But he's one of the people, including I think the other one was Carl Froch, who when I listened to him speak, I said, okay, I'm sold. You got me. I'm behind you. I believe you can do every single thing you just told me you could do. And being that he did win his last fight, Jenna, like you mentioned, over someone who still has something left, it does show a lot. And I'm not sure exactly how he's going to win this fight. I'm not sure I'd be bold to pick him by KO or by a UD, maybe even a split decision or a majority decision, something like that. But I'm going to have to pick McCall to go with this upset, despite the personal problems that he's had recently. Hopefully it doesn't affect him like they did in the Lennox-Lewis rematch. As he told us, that was why, of course, the infamous scene where he was crying in the ring. But I don't think it'll be that big of a deal for him. I think that at this point of his career, I think he's just trying to be focused on fighting. And at 45 years old, I'm not too sure that he's going to be taking it any less serious than he should be, because he knows that his back's against the wall in terms of trying to prove himself in this day and age. So, yeah, I'm gonna pick the upset, too, and I'm going with Oliver McCall winning this fight.
All right, all three of us picking the upset here. Maybe we're a little biased. Maybe we actually do see something here. For all the listeners out there, there's another fight this week I quickly want to tell you about. We mentioned it earlier when I was talking about Ivan Calderon. Rondel Mayall facing a rematch against Omar Nino. If you saw his first fight there, the first fight, there was a lot of controversy involved with the way that bout ended. The rematch will be taking place on Fox Sports Espanol on Saturday, so hopefully you guys check that out. It is a title fight, and it could be the next opponent for Ivan Calderon, so hopefully you tune in for that. But anyways, guys, I want to also remind you, if you want to find anything else from the On the Ropes Boxing Radio show, you can go to www.ontheropesboxingradio. We have promo videos, articles, the whole bit, and, of course, the Rummy's Prediction League, which I currently rule atop, and no one's taking me off my high seat. So, hey, but if you're willing to try, go for it. But anyways, I think that's just about it. I think we covered all bases here, and I'd like to thank our two guests that we had on here. We had Teddy Atlas, fantastic interview. Also, we have seen The Rock Rockman, great to get his perspective on his upcoming fight. My co-host, Jeff Ciani, great as always. Nick Powers, pleasure. All the fans listening out there, hope you enjoyed. Catch us next time.